goes and you won't stand firm. Rush ahead and you won't go far. Try to shine and you'll extinguish your light. Try to define yourself, you won't know who you are. Don't try to control others. Let go and let them be. As I read this book, it calms me without effort, fills in the blanks of my strategy for survival. Control by letting go of control. Fix your problems by forgetting their problems. Deal with them and the world and yourself with patience and simplicity and compassion. Let things be. Let yourself be. Let everything be and accept it as it is. Nothing more, nothing less, nothing more. I am prepared. I am calm. I will accept what comes. I walk out of the room. My parents are waiting for me on the other side of the clinic. I walk through the halls. My eyes are forward but focused on nothing. Each step is a step and nothing more than a step, a method for taking me from this place to that place. As I turn corners, I hear sounds. They sound as they are. They just sound as they sound. The Tao told me what I needed to hear, and I listened. The Tao taught me what I needed to be taught, and I learned. The sounds just sound. I stop in front of the door to Joanne's office. I knock on it. Her voice says, "Come in," so I open the door and I go inside. My mother and my father are sitting on the couch. They have changed clothes again, and they are holding hands. Their eyes are dry and their lips steady. They stand to greet me, but they don't try to hug me. I say hello to them, and I don't try to hug them either. I sit down in the chair across from them, and they sit back down. Joanne is behind her desk. She's smoking a cigarette. "Your parents told me about their new smoking policy, and they extended it to me. I hope you don't mind." I pull out a cigarette. "Not at all." I reach for an ashtray. "We were talking about our session this morning. Your parents have some thoughts and feelings on it, but we thought we'd start with yours." I light my cigarette, take a drag. I exhale. "I hated this morning." Joanne looks at me. "I think you need to be more specific, and I think you need to tell your parents, not me." I look at my parents. They are holding hands, and they are looking at me. "I'm sorry about what I told you this morning. It must have been terrible for you to have to sit through it. As I was doing it, I felt a number of things. The first was anger, intense anger. I don't know why, but whenever I'm near you, I feel incredibly and uncontrollably angry. The second feeling I had was horror. Horror because as I get some distance from myself, I'm realizing what a truly horrible person I am. I've hidden a lot from you, as much as I could, and I can't imagine what it must have been like for you to have to sit through the details of my monstrous existence." I take another drag of my smoke. My mother moves closer to my father. My father holds her a little tighter. I felt shame, enormous amounts of shame. I felt shame because of who I am, what I've done, the way I've lived my life, the crimes I've committed. I felt shame because you're good people, and you deserve better than me. I felt shame because I hurt you, have hurt you over and over, and every time I did it, including this morning, I knew I was doing it. I take another drag. I felt regret for a lot of the same reasons I felt shame, but also because I have wasted so much of my life and so much of your life, and because on some level, it didn't have to be this way. I don't know what way it should have been or how I could have changed myself, but I know that my life should not have been the way that it has been. I know that it is entirely my fault. Another drag. I felt like I wanted to drink. I felt like I wanted to do drugs. I felt like I wanted large amounts of both of them. I feel that way most of the time, though, so I don't know if it was specific to our conversation. I felt humiliation, disgrace, embarrassment, remorse, and sadness. I finish and I take a final drag of my cigarette and I put it out in the ashtray. My father is holding my mother and my mother is crying. Tears are running down her cheeks, but her breathing is fine and there is no sobbing. Joanne looks at my parents. Are you ready? My father speaks. Yes. Why don't you tell James how you felt? My father takes a deep breath and he looks at me and he speaks. I wish he would look away. We were upset. Obviously very upset. The first thing I really felt was surprise, and after surprise I felt shock. I know I work a lot, and I always have, and I'm not around as much as I would like to be, but I had no idea you have been doing some of the things you have been doing, and I had no idea as to the extent to which you have been doing them. I think of crack as some horrible ghetto drug that homeless people and schizophrenics and gang members smoke. I had no idea you did it, and it scares me, and it upsets me to think about it. The alcohol. I knew you had a drinking problem. That had been obvious for a very long time. But if you have been getting sick and blacking out for as long as you say you have, and I believe you, you are a very, very serious alcoholic. I was shocked by the drug dealing. Shocked, horrified, and disappointed. If you had been caught, you would have gone to prison for a long time, and you're lucky you weren't caught. You also could have been killed. And I sort of think it's a miracle that you haven't been. As far as whatever your situations with the law are now, I don't really know what to say. Obviously, your mother and I don't want you to go to prison, and we'll do whatever we can to help you stay out of it. Aside from shock and surprise, I was disappointed and hurt and very sad. I was disappointed in you, and in me, and in your mother. There is something very wrong between us if things have gotten to this point. I was hurt, because it hurts to learn things like the things we learned. It hurt because I feel as if I have been lied to and duped for many years, and it hurt to know you thought you had to lie to us and hide things from us. I was mainly sad for you. Sad because you've been through some awful things, and no parent, especially your mother and me, would ever want that for their child. He looks down, takes a breath, looks back at me. Part of me wanted to wring your neck this morning, and part of me still does. Another part of me, the part I'm trying to let stay in control, wants to give you a hug and tell you everything's going to be all right. Another part of me says I should just give up and let you do whatever it is you're gonna do. My father stares at me. I look away. He turns to my mother, who is staring at the floor. He pulls her in tight, reassuring her through his arms. I speak. Dad. He looks back at me. I'm sorry. I am too, James. I am too. He looks back at my mother. Her tears have stopped, though they have streaked her face. Lynn, my mother nods. Are you ready? Mother nods again, and she looks as if she's going to break down. Take your time. She pulls away from him slightly, and she straightens herself out. She wipes her face with a tissue, and she takes a deep breath. Aside from the days when my parents and my brother and my sister died, this morning was the worst morning of my life. I hated it. I hated hearing about all that stuff. I hated thinking about you having done it. I hated thinking about all the lies and the deception. I hated thinking about the drugs. I hated the stuff with the police. I hated the drinking. I hated thinking it had been going on for so long. I hated everything about this morning. She is crying. She wipes her face with her tissue again, and she takes a deep breath. I don't know why you do these things. I don't know what drives you to do such terrible things. It makes me think that I'm a terrible mother and a terrible person and that I haven't done anything right ever. It makes me hate myself. Her breathing is becoming more labored. She wipes her face again. I was shocked and hurt and scared. I feel like I don't know who you are. I don't know who you are, and that's awful. You're my son. You're my son. She breathes, cries, wipes. I'm angry at you for all of this. It's such a mess. Crack and blacking out and selling drugs and fighting with the police and jail. It's just such a mess. It's my worst nightmare. Cries become sobs, tears a flood. It makes me feel like a jerk for letting it happen and for defending you for all these years. Whenever anyone said anything bad about you, I defended you and told them they were wrong. I guess I was wrong. She doesn't bother wiping the tears anymore. I had so many dreams for you. She sobs. You could have been anything you wanted. Anything. Sobs. And you're this. Sobs. This. My father puts his arms around her. She buries her face in his chest. She wails and she heaves. She clutches the sleeves of his shirt. I sit and I watch and I wait. I don't know what to do. I want to give my parents a hug and tell them I'm sorry, but I can't. I want to beg for their forgiveness, but it's not going to happen. I want to take their hands and tell them everything is going to be okay, but that's not a promise I know I can make. I sit and I watch and I wait. I don't know what to do. I want to touch them, but I can't. My mother continues to cry. She cannot, will not, is unable to stop. My father holds her and he stares at the floor over her shoulder. Joanne stands and she walks to me and she leans to my ear. I think you should go. I stand. You have a meeting with Daniel and your parents tomorrow morning. It's in the same room we were in earlier. I walk to the door. Before I leave, I turn and I look at my mother and my father. My mother is crying, my father staring at the floor. Joanne is down on one knee and she is whispering kind words to them, words that I do not deserve to hear. I open the door and I walk out. I make my way back to the unit. Night has fallen and the halls are dark. Overhead lights illuminate them. I hate the lights. I want them gone. I wish the halls were darker. I am craving the dark, the darkest darkness, the deep and horrible hole. I wish the halls were fucking black. My mind is black. My heart is black. I wish the halls were black. If I could, I would destroy the lights above me with a fucking bat. I would smash them to fucking pieces. I wish the halls were black. I open the door to my room. I walk in and I sit down on my bed. Miles is not here, and I am alone. My mind is black and my heart is black, and I am alone. I take off my shoes and I take off my socks. I pull my foot, my right foot, onto the thigh of my left leg. I look down at my toes. They are dirty and gnarled and foul with sweat. I am alone, and the fury is within me. It is not raging, nor near its height, but it is there. It flows through my veins like a slow, lazy virus, urging me to do damage, but not enough damage to constitute destruction. I want it to go away. I want it to leave me. When it is at its full, I am often at its mercy, but not now. I know what to do to make it go away. I know how to make it disappear. Feed it pain, and it will leave me. Feed it pain, and it will go away. With the thumb and forefinger of my right hand, I start pulling at the nail of the second toe of my left foot. I know it's sick, a sick fucking symptom of an infected mind, but I do it anyway. I pull. I pull at the nail. It is always this toe, always this nail. As it has grown back from my last bout with it, it has grown in a way that makes it easy to do it again. It sticks up a little higher than the rest of my nails. Its shape is more ragged. It has edges that I can get beneath, edges that provide leverage. I pull. I pull at the nail. It starts to break away at its tip. It starts to hurt. The fury inside of me howls with delight. Give me more! Give me more! I pull and the nail breaks further. It tears the skin that holds it in place, severs the veins that feed it. Blood starts to flow. The pain starts moving. Like the blood, the pain is red. It moves down my toe and into my foot. It dances around my ankle. I can feel the fury feeding on it. Give me more! Give me more! I look down. My fingers and my foot are covered in blood. I can see the nail through the red, see it hang by its base. I know the fury sees it, because I can feel it. It feels like a starving demon. Feed me, feed me, feed me that goddamn nail. Feed me, you motherfucker, or I will ruin you. Feed me that goddamn nail. I put my finger above the nail, and my thumb between it and the exposed pink flesh of my toe. My thumb brushes the flesh, and the pain turns from red to white, and it shoots up my leg and into my stomach. It is instantly devoured, and there is an instant call for more. Feed me, you motherfucker, or I will ruin you. Feed me that goddamn nail. I pull at the nail. One half of it rips from its base. I close my eyes. My hand is covered in blood. I clench my jaw and I cry out softly. I cry. The pain is overwhelming and I am full of it. From the tips of my hair all the way down and through everything, everywhere. The pain is everywhere. The fury is gobbling it up. The demon is drinking. One more tear and it will be full. I pull at the nail. It tears free and I cry out. My cry is not so soft this time. Pain is everywhere, white and flaming and cold as hell. Every cell in my body is twitching and electric, full of hate and thankful with relief. The fury rises briefly, rises with a smile and screams, bloody murder, thank you. It eats the pain. It drinks it. It takes it every way it can. It makes it go away. Go away now. I have given you what you wanted. Go away now. I let out a deep breath. A deep, deep breath like that after ecstasy. Like that after your life has flashed before your eyes. I look at my foot. It is covered in blood, as is my hand. I stand and I walk to the bathroom. As I step with my damaged foot, I place only the heel on the floor. Every time it hits, there is a throbbing bolt of electric red and white lightning. Every time it hits, the bolt is eaten. I open the door. I step toward the sink, carefully avoiding the mirror. When I reach the sink, I turn on the cold water. I wait until it gets as cold as it can get. When it arrives the coldest the sink can provide, I lift my foot into the air and place it beneath the faucet. Drops of blood hit the floor as I lift, and I lean over to wipe them with my clean hand. The water meets the flesh, and everything is pink. The pink runs down the drain, and more pink follows it. The cold cauterizes the pain, and the fury cleans it, licks its lips of the last of it, and fades away. I stand and I wait. I clean my hand. Everything is pink. Blood is flowing. After a moment or two, a few brief moments, the pressure from the water seals the wounds on my toe and closes the torn ends of the broken vessels. The toe throbs. It's not so bad. I would rather have the throb than the alternative. I would rather feed it than let it run wild. I turn off the water, and I remove my foot from the sink, and I walk back to my bed. I put on my sock, and I put on my shoe. I leave the room. It is almost time for me to leave. Almost 10 o'clock. I walk into the unit. Men are scattered about the room. They are watching TV, playing cards, smoking cigarettes and telling stories, waiting for the phone. Leonard is in the phone booth, and I can hear complaints about the time he is spending there. Complaints, but no action. Against most men, there would be action. I get a cup of coffee. A man dressed in black sweatpants and a black T-shirt is standing against a wall on the lower level of the unit. He is in his mid-20s, and though he is thin, he looks strong. He is smoking a cigarette, and he is staring at me. Something in him strikes me as familiar, though I don't know from where, and something in him strikes me as menacing, though I do not know why. He is just standing there staring at me. I stand my ground and I stare back. There is no effort behind his stare. He believes whatever it is that is going through his mind. He's familiar and menacing. I don't know why. He chuckles and he moves off the wall and he pulls his eyes away from me. And he walks toward one of the couches in front of the TV and he sits down. I watch him the entire way. I stood my ground. I have a feeling I will need to stand again. I walk back to my room with my coffee. Miles is sitting on his bed, polishing his clarinet. He looks up at me when I enter. What's up, Miles?
Not a thing, James. How are you?
I'm okay. I sit on my bed, start putting on warmer clothes.
How did it go with your parents this evening?
Fine, I guess.
How did they react?
Not as badly as I thought they would, but bad enough.
How did you feel about it?
About the same.
But more ashamed than anything else?
Probably.
Shame is a terrible thing. Necessary, but terrible.
You're still fighting with it?
I suspect I'm going to be for a long time.
Why?
I am not a good man, James.
You're a judge. You can't be that bad.
I am a judge, but in my heart, I know I don't deserve to sit in judgment over anyone.
You're just being hard on yourself, he shakes his head.
I haven't told anyone this, though the staff knows, but I have been here before. This is my second term at this clinic.
When was your first?
The first time was years ago. I came because, like now, I had a very bad drinking problem, a problem that nearly destroyed me. It almost destroyed my career, and in many ways it destroyed my first marriage, which was to a wonderful woman with whom I had a son.
How old is he?
He's 12 now. He's a fine young man. I wish I got to see him more.
So you're here again. That is nothing to be ashamed of.
He sets down his clarinet.
It is, James. For me it is.
Why? It took me years to get over what happened last time. Years of long nights alone, looking at myself in the mirror, years of hard work staying sober, and years trying to make up for my indiscretions. Now, after all that, I have done it again.
Why do you think that?
I have mentioned my wife to you before. She is a great woman. She is smart, beautiful, challenging, independent, successful in her field. She is everything I have always sought in a partner. When I first met her, I knew right away I wanted to marry her. On our first date, I told her of my history. I wanted to be honest with her, and in being honest with her, I hoped to not repeat that history. After I told her, she smiled and said, "Miles, you are a beautiful man." And I knew from the first second I saw you that we were going to be together. But if you pull that type of shit on me, I will kick your ass and leave you like yesterday's garbage. I chuckle. He smiles. I liked that she said that, too. And I liked it even more because I knew she meant it. I thought it would be good for me to know that if I went astray again, I would be punished for my sins. We were married. We lived as husband and wife for several years. We decided to have children, and she got pregnant. I was feeling very confident, perhaps too confident, about who I was and how I could live my life. He stops, looks at the floor, takes a deep breath. Around this same time, I went to a conference for federal judges. It was in Florida, on the beach, at a very nice hotel. There was a golf course there, and on the first day of the conference, I played golf with some other judges that I was friendly with, but did not know well. After we finished playing, we went to an outdoor restaurant for dinner. It was a gorgeous night, and I had played well, and I had just spoken with my wife, and I was at the pinnacle of my career, and I felt good, very good about who I was and what I had done with my life. When it came time to order, all of the other judges ordered cocktails. I decided I would as well. I ordered a whiskey and coke. I thought that I could handle it. As soon as I took my first sip and I felt the alcohol hit me, I knew I was in trouble. He shakes his head. I left the table a few minutes later and went to my room and drank most of what was in the minibar. I slept in the next day and skipped the conference, and when the minibar was refilled, I did it again. When I went home, I started hiding liquor in my house, in my office, and in my car, and I drank as much as I could. Soon enough, I was drinking all day and drinking all night. I started keeping a bottle of bourbon under my bench. I would put it in a glass and drink it during court proceedings. I pretended it was water, and I consumed it like it was water. I tried to stop, and I couldn't. I passed out one afternoon during a recess in proceedings, and when I came to, an officer of the court was waiting for me. He told me that my wife had been trying to call me, and had left several urgent messages. I immediately went to see her, and when she asked if I was all right, I told her that I was sick with the flu. She knew I was lying, and she confronted me. She told me that she had warned me about falling off the wagon, and that she had known that I had been drinking very heavily. She had hoped I would stop, but now realized that I wouldn't. I tried to deny there was a problem, but she pulled out several bottles that she had found in various places where I had hidden them, and told me it was time to stop lying. Then she told me to leave. I immediately came here. He takes a deep breath. My wife arrives here next week for the family program. I am expecting the worst, and I feel like I deserve it. I have now done this more than once, and I feel it is deplorable. And I feel it is the worst type of crime a man can commit against his family. I hate myself for it, and I am ashamed of it, deeply, deeply ashamed. At certain points in my career, I have sentenced men to death by execution. I feel in many ways that would be a reasonable sentence for me. I know that sounds melodramatic, but to me, it sounds right. He shakes his head. I am ashamed to the point where I don't know if I want to go on living. I don't know you well, but I sense that you are struggling with some of these same issues. I can also see you changing, that you seem to be finding ways to handle them. When I ask you questions about what you're doing, it is because I am seeking a way to give myself hope for some form of redemption. I am a believer in God, but God no longer seems to believe in me. If you know anything, or have anything that you think might help me, I would be very thankful if you would be kind enough to share it with me. I smile. Why are you smiling? Because I think it's funny that a federal judge is asking me for advice. We are all the same in here, judge or criminal, bourbon drinker or crackhead. I guess so. Do you have anything you might be able to share with me, James? I got two things. What are they? The first thing is Leonard. West Coast Finance Director Leonard? I laugh. Yeah, West Coast Finance Director Leonard. You should go talk to him. Tell him I sent you, and tell him you want to hear about holding on. Holding on to what? Just ask him. I will do that. What is the second thing? You ever see me reading that little book? I point to the Tao. It is sitting on my nightstand. Yes? In about 30 seconds, I'm going to climb out that window above your bed. Miles laughs. After I'm gone, pick up the book and give it a read. You might think it's nonsense, and it very well may be nonsense, but it seems to do me good whenever I read it. Why do you think it does that? It just makes sense to me. I'll give it a try. I stand, walk toward his bed. You mind letting me through? He moves out of the way. I'm not going to ask you where you're going or what you're doing. That's probably best. Be careful not to get caught. I open the window and I step through it, and I close it behind me. I feel the cold immediately. It is strong, bitter, tense, and angry. It bites at my face and the exposed skin of my hands like a termite bites at wood. I start walking. I walk quickly, avoiding all light and avoiding all windows. In the shadows, I am safe, and I am strong, and I am comfortable. I know I won't get caught in the shadows. I find the trail, and I let it take me toward the clearing. I step off where I always step off, and I push my way through thick tangles of branches and through a tapestry of evergreens. As I approach the clearing, I start to rush. My eyes see, but my mind registers moments of the future, soon to be in Lily's arms. A branch strikes me. Across my cheek it tears the skin. Not deep, but deep enough. I step into the clearing, and she is there. She is sitting on frozen ground, wrapped in a blanket, her pale skin shining. She smiles and she stands, and without words, she steps forward, opens the blanket, envelops me within it, and within her, and within myself. She kisses my cheek, the one not torn. She wraps me, and she holds me. Her arms are thin but strong. She whispers in my ear, "I'm glad you're here." "So am I. I missed you." "I missed you, too." She releases me a little, enough to gain space. She steps to my side. "Let's sit." She stays at my side, and she guides me down. We sit on frozen dirt and sharp leaves and brittle sticks. She reaches up and she delicately touches my cut cheek. "What happened?" "I ran into a branch."
"You couldn't see?"
"I wasn't paying attention."
"You want me to make it better?"
"How are you gonna do that?"
"I've got special powers."
"Really?
You want to see?"
"Yeah." She leans forward, and she starts to kiss my cheek. I pull away.
"What are you doing?"
"Healing you.
That's a fresh wound."
"I know.
That's running blood."
"I know."
"You're willing to take that risk?"
She leans forward.
"I am."
I don't stop her. Her lips hit my cheek slightly open. Her tongue dances across the flesh of my face. I close my eyes. She pulls herself toward me, her arms holding thin and strong. I move myself toward her, my arms open and free. She kisses down my cheek to the edge of my mouth. It responds. It says, "Come," and we meet. Our open mouths meet. Fast and slow, alternating hard and soft, pressing and receiving, seeking and being sought, loving and being loved. We are beneath the blanket. We slide to the ground. It is no longer cold. She is on me, and I am on her, side by side, our hands wandering along the length of the other. Our hands meet. Embrace. Hold our hands. A current connected physically and otherwise. She slips her hand away out of mine, and it moves down my chest, my stomach, beneath my stomach, down. I like it there, feel it there, want it there, but fear interlopes, great fear. I am scared. I push her hand away, gently push it away. We are still together, our lips meeting. She moves her hand back. I push it away. I am scared. Great, overwhelming fear. Fear near panic fear. She pulls our lips apart. She speaks.
"What's wrong?"
"I can't go any further."
"You're shaking."
"I know."
"Why?"
"I'm scared."
"Of what?"
"Everything."
"What's that mean?"
"I'm just scared."
"Of me?"
"No." She pulls me closer.
"I'm not gonna hurt you."
"I know."
"I'm not gonna leave you."
"I know."
"Tell me why you're scared."
I look at her face close to me, at her eyes, clear blue. Even in the dark, they are clear water blue. "I've never done this before."
"What?"
"What I think we're going to do."
"What do you mean?"
"I've never done it before."
"You've never had sex?"
"I have, but not like this."
"What do you mean?"
"Never sober."
"What about that girlfriend?"
"Never."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
"I'm not gonna hurt you."
"I know."
"Why?"
I take a deep breath. I'm scared. I speak. She was a virgin when I met her. She had been saving herself until she fell in love. After a couple of months, she decided that she was ready. We talked about it, and we set a date, and we went out for a fancy dinner. I was really nervous. So I drank through the whole date before to try and calm myself down. When we got back to her room, she had candles burning and flowers on her bed and classical music playing on her stereo, and it was like something out of a silly movie. We started fooling around, and when it came time, I couldn't get it up. I wanted to more than anything in my whole life, but I couldn't do it because I was scared and I was drunk. I take another breath, start to shake more, feel more scared. I hate the memories, and I hate myself for creating them. We tried again and again and again. We tried every night for a couple of weeks, and I could never do it. Each time I failed, I felt worse and worse and more humiliated and embarrassed. She was offering herself to me, and I couldn't take her because I was impotent. Every time we tried, I was fucking impotent. We stayed together for a while, but we weren't really together. We were just sort of each other's habit. In her case, it was a bad habit. In my case, it was a good one. The last time we tried to have sex, I decided to tell her that I loved her. I thought that if I did that, it would make my fear go away, and everything would work. We were naked and in bed, and I was okay, and I looked into her eyes. She had these eyes, very blue, not like yours, but lighter and more like ice. And I looked into them, and I said, "I love you." She didn't say anything back. She just stared at me with those eyes, and they were cold and empty and far away. And they looked as if what I had said had made them sick. I said it again, and she pushed me off of her, and she got out of bed, and she went to the bathroom. When she came back, she smiled, and she said, "I think you're a very special person." And she kissed me on the cheek, and she turned over and went to sleep. I take a deep breath. I had thought for a long time that if I could be with her, that she would be enough to make me straighten myself out. I had thought for a long time that somehow she could save me. When I was impotent with her, and I knew I had failed and it was over, I knew that I would never be anything but a drunk, impotent, embarrassing asshole, and that I might as well start seriously trying to kill myself with alcohol and drugs. So I did, and everywhere I went I saw her eyes. And when I think of her, I still see them. Her eyes at that moment when I told her I loved her, and I could see that I made her sick. I stare into the blackness. It offers nothing. I am flooded with the feelings I felt with her. They come back just as strong. Humiliation, embarrassment, shame, helplessness, impotence. Lily holds me, but leaves me to me. I stare into the blackness and I breathe. There is nothing that will change the past and nothing that will help me forget it. It was what it was, and it was what it was because of me. I wish it were different, but there's nothing I can do. It's in the past. It is time to accept it and let it go. Lily pulls back. She looks at me and she speaks.
"You stopped shaking.
For now.
When it happens, we'll go slow."
"That would be nice."
"As slow as you want or you need."
"Thank you."
"And it'll be nice for me, too."
"Why?"
"We sort of talked about this before."
"A little."
"Do you need more than a little?"
"I need what you want to give me."
"I want to give you everything."
"Then tell me what you need to tell me." She pauses, smiles.
"This is scary."
"I know."
"Really scary." "I'm not going to hurt you."
She smiles again.
"I know."
"And I'm not going to leave you."
"I know."
"And
I'm not going to judge you."
"Thank you." She smiles, looks away for a moment, looks back. Her smile disappears and the brightness of her eyes fades, and she starts speaking. She tells me about her mother, about her mother's addictions and her mother's pain. She tells me about her mother's work as a prostitute and how her mother sold her. She was 13. A man who paid for her mother saw her, and he wanted her. Her mother needed drugs. Her mother sold her to the man for $200, sold her for an hour and sold her for a lifetime, sold her virginity for a syringe full of dope. $200 for a syringe full of dope. She tells me about the men after that man, how her mother sold her regularly and stopped working herself. She tells me about the pain and the misery and the horror, man after man, day after day, violation after violation. There were always syringes full of dope, paid for with her body. She tells me how she started using them, how she hated them, and how they helped her, man after man, day after day, violation after violation. The syringes helped. She tells how she left. After 4 years of terror, a man beat her and used a loaded gun on her and in her, and after he was done, she walked out. She didn't have any money or any belongings. She didn't have a car. She just walked out and kept walking, hitchhiking her way to Chicago, paying for it on her back with a few minutes satisfying truckers. When she got to Chicago, she called information and she found her grandmother. She had never met her when she went to her house. She knocked on the door, and her grandmother opened it, and they both started crying. There were no words, just tears. She and her grandmother crying. She tells me how she went back to school, how the boys loved her and the girls hated her, how she felt as if she was so far behind, how hard it was to stay away and stay clean and be decent, how hard it was to forget, how it was impossible to forget, how she met a boy and she liked him and she started going out with him, how she had hopes and dreams, how she played out fantasies in her mind. The boy started smoking crack and using pills, and she wanted to be with him, and she went along with him. She started smoking crack and using pills. He started using her. His friends started using her. Her heart was broken. It had never healed. It just broke again. She was smoking crack and using pills. He and his friends used her. Something happened. She starts to speak of it, and she starts to cry. It was shortly before she came here, shortly before her grandmother made her drive herself toward freedom. She stops speaking and she starts to cry. Heavy, violent tears, heaving sobs. She shakes and I can feel her heart through layers and layers of clothing, through layers and layers of pain. I hold her and she cries, and there are no words anymore, not from her or from me. There are no words that mean anything in the face of how she has lived her life, in what she has endured. I hold her and she cries. I am not going anywhere. I'm not going to hurt her. I'm not going to leave her. I'm not going to judge her. I hold her and she cries. I hear my name. I feel someone kicking me. I'm not sure if it is real. I am not sure what to do. My name. A foot. Someone is calling me. Someone is kicking me. I open my eyes. It is still dark, but getting lighter. Somewhere in the hour before dawn, I see outlines of trees and Lily in my arms. Someone is calling me. Someone is kicking me. I look up. Ted is standing above me with a blonde girl in her late 20s. Both look tired. Both have messy hair. Ted speaks.
I thought you were dead, you little fucker. What are you doing here? Saving your ass. What time is it? Time to fucking go.
I gently shake Lily. She opens her eyes.
What? We gotta go. Who are you talking to?
A friend. His name's Ted.
What time is it? I don't know.
We stand. I'm awake, but not completely. Lily isn't even close. She knows the girl with Ted, and they say hello. I kiss her goodbye, and I tell her I'll miss her. She asks me when we'll see each other again, and I tell her tonight. Ted and I walk through the woods toward the trail. I ask him what he was doing, and he says getting laid. He asks me what I was doing, and I say talking. He laughs. I ask him if he's been out here before, and he says every goddamn night. He asks me, and I tell him no, it was my first time. We hit the trail. He says be careful and get ready to run. If we get caught out here, we'll be in deep shit. I haven't run anywhere in a long time. I don't have the lungs for it. The trail fades into the grass surrounding the buildings of the clinic. We make it inside safely, and I go to my room and I climb into bed. I wish I was still with Lily. I fall asleep. I wish she was here. When I wake up, Miles is gone, but there is a note on my nightstand. It is sitting on top of the dow. It reads, "Thank you, James. It made sense." The note makes me smile. The alarm inside tells me I'm late, so I take a quick shower, brush my teeth, dry off, and get dressed. Leave. I hurry through the halls to the dining hall. When I arrive, it is nearly empty. I get a donut and a cup of coffee, and I leave. More halls. I hurry. I'm late to meet my parents. The fury is with me, but barely. It is still full from its feeding. I find the room, open the door. My parents are sitting at the conference table with Daniel on one side of them, and a man I don't know, dressed like my father, but slightly younger, on the other side. My mother is crying.
What's wrong?
She shakes her head. I look to my father.
What's wrong?
He stands, speaks. James, this is Randall. He motions to the man, who also stands. He's an attorney who works for the clinic. I look at the man.
Hello, Randall.
He reaches over the table.
Hello, James.
We shake hands. My father speaks. He's been talking to the authorities in Michigan, North Carolina, and Ohio.
What did they say?
Why don't you sit down? I sit down. I'm nervous and scared. They sit down.
What did they say?
My father looks at Randall. Randall looks at a file. My mother cries, and she stares at the floor. Daniel stares at me. I am nervous and scared, starting to shake. The day of judgment has arrived. The day of judgment. Randall looks up.
I have good news and bad news.
Which would you like first?
The good?
Michigan and North Carolina want misdemeanor possession. Your time in here will be time served. You'll have some fines, a couple $1,000s in each place, and your record will be cleared in 3 years. The courts in both places are overloaded and want this to go away. I'd recommend going along with what they've offered. My father speaks.
So would I, James.
I nod.
Okay, what's the bad news?
Randall speaks. You're in a lot of trouble in Ohio. It's a small town, and they don't see much like what they saw with you. They say that you caused quite a few problems there and made a number of enemies within the police department. They are incredibly angry as any prosecutors that I have ever had to deal with on a case, and they want to make an example out of you. They don't particularly care that you are here and that you're trying to get your life in order. They say they have an open and shut case, and they'll be happy to go to trial. I believe them. He takes a deep breath. I'm nervous and scared. Scared to fucking death. The day of my judgment has arrived. If you agree to plead guilty to all of the charges, they'll agree to 3 years in state prison, followed by 5 years of probation. If you violate your probation, you will be required to serve the full term of the sentence, which is an additional 5 years. You will be required to pay $15,000 in fines and to fulfill 1,000 hours of community service upon release. Your driving privileges in the state will be permanently revoked. Your record will be permanently marked. If you force them to go to trial, they're saying that if you're convicted, they will press for the maximum sentence, which is 8.5 years. As far as the trial prospects go, they are claiming to have 30 witnesses, a blood test registering your blood alcohol level at 0.29, and a bag of crack cocaine. If that's true, as they say, it's an open and shut case. The fear is gone, replaced by horror. My father stares at me. My mother cries. Daniel looks at the wall. Randall waits for a response.
Fuck.
My mother looks up.
Could you not say that word, James?
I look at her. I was basically just sentenced to 3 years in prison, Mom. What the fuck am I supposed to say? Her lips quiver.
Please.
I clench my jaw.
Fine.
My father speaks. Any ideas?
No.
Do you think they have all of that evidence?
Yes.
What do you want to do? I look at Randall.
What can I do?
He shrugs. I can go back to them with something, but I'm not optimistic about it.
What's that mean?
It means they probably won't budge. I shake my head. Think about 3 years in a state prison. A moment ago, fear became horror. At this moment, the fear has come back and the horror is still here. 3 years in a state prison. 3 years of savagery, 3 years of fighting, and 3 years protecting myself every second of every day. 3 fucking years.
What if I run?
My father speaks.
No more running.
I look at him.
This is my decision, Dad.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
You're not paying for whatever it costs.
You gonna be in the cell with me?
No, I'm not.
Then I am paying for whatever it costs.
I look at Randall.
What if I run?
My father speaks.
I won't allow that to happen.
I ignore him.
What if I run, Randall?
There is a 7-year statute of limitations. If you stay out of trouble, at the end of that term, you're a free man. If you get caught for anything, at any point during that time, even a traffic ticket, you'll likely be jailed, extradited, tried, and forced to serve the full term. I would highly, highly, highly recommend against that course of action.
I put my face in my hands, speak to myself.
Fuck.
My mother speaks.
James.
I look up at my mother.
Sorry.
She's crying and her lips are quivering. My father speaks.
What would you like to do?
I don't know.
Would you like to mount a defense?
It'd be a waste of time and money.
Why?
Because I'm guilty of all the charges.
Your mother and I will pay for it.
You've paid enough. I don't want you to pay any more.
What do you want to do?
I need to think.
I stare at the floor. I'm guilty of all the charges. 3 years in a state prison is an eternity, a fucking eternity. And it's likely I'll be put in maximum security. I've never been there, but I know people who have been there. They did not come out rehabilitated, and they did not come out resembling who they were when they went in. Addicts became thieves. Thieves became dealers. Dealers became killers. Killers killed again.
I look up at Randall. Tell them I'll plead guilty to everything.
My mother interrupts.
You'll be a convicted felon.
Doesn't look like I have a choice about that, Mom. I look at Randall. I'll plead guilty, but for now, tell them I'll keep running unless I get some placement other than placement on a maximum security block. Try and get the time down if you can. If there's any sort of choice, which sounds like an incredible long shot, I would rather do more time than go into max.
Randall nods, speaks. You said for now. What's later?
I don't know.
He looks to my father.
Does this sound okay to you?
My father speaks.
Let's see what happens.
Randall looks at his watch, closes his file, stands.
I need to go. I'll call North Carolina and Michigan and tell them we've got deals. I'll call Ohio and see what I can do. I can't promise anything.
I stand, reach for his hand.
Thank you.
He takes it.
You're welcome.
My father does the same and Randall walks out. My mother is staring at the floor. She looks as if she wants to cry, but there are no more tears.
Daniel speaks.
Would you like to be alone?
My father nods.
Yes, please.
Daniel stands. I'll be at the family center if you need anything.
Thank you.
Daniel leaves. My father stares at the table, my mother at the floor. I stare at the wall. There is an awful, uncomfortable silence. The type of silence just after a bomb explodes and just before the screaming starts. We sit in our chairs. We breathe. We think. We stare. It is awful and uncomfortable. The bomb has exploded. We all just sit and stare. The wall isn't giving me any answers. It just sits there, bright and white. I look up and see my father take a deep breath and look up at me. It has been an interesting and enlightening day and a half.
I'm sorry.
He shakes his head.
It's much worse than I thought, James.
I know. I'm sorry.
I don't know if we can help you this time.
I don't think you should.
We're your parents. It's our instinct to try and help you.
I don't think you can this time, Dad.
He shakes his head. My mother speaks.
I'm sorry, James.
I look at her.
You've got nothing to be sorry for, Mom.
I am, though. I just keep wondering what we did wrong.
You didn't do anything wrong, Mom.
We must have done something.
She starts to break down. My father stands and he goes to her. He pulls out a chair next to her and he puts his arms around her. She buries her face in his shoulder. She cries. I watch her cry. I can't take this anymore. I can't take her crying. I can't take the guilt I feel because of it. I can't let her take responsibility for what I am and for what I have done. I can't let her try to accept any of the blame. I created this situation, and I made the decisions that led me to where I am today. I made every goddamn one of them. It's not her fault, nor anyone else's fault. I can't take this anymore. I can't take it. I push my chair back. I stand. My father is holding my mother as my mother cries. She is crying because of me. I step toward them. I step again. I am two steps away. I step again. I am one step away. They are not paying attention to me. They are lost in their own sorrow. Sorrow they do not deserve. Sorrow I have dumped down upon them. I step again. I am there. I am next to them. I am there. The fury speaks. It says no. The fury speaks. It says turn and run. The fury speaks. It says fuck them. Let them deal with it. The fury speaks. It says, I will make you pay. I say, fuck the fury. My mother is crying, fuck the goddamn fury. I get down on one knee. I am close enough to smell her tears. I reach forward and I touch my mother's shoulder. It is the first time in all of my memory that I have initiated contact with either my mother or my father. I firm my grip so she knows it is there. It is the first time in all of my memory that I have initiated contact with either my mother or my father. The first time in my life. She lifts her head and she turns toward me. I speak. Mom, she stares at me. I'm sorry. She has been broken. Truly, truly sorry. Broken by me. I fucked up your life. All of our lives. And I'm truly, truly sorry. She smiles a smile of happiness and a smile of sorrow. Happiness for my gesture and sorrow for my life. And she takes one of her arms from around the width of my father and she puts it around me. She pulls me in. She hugs me with one arm and I let her, and I hug her back. I have never done this before. Hug my mother. Never in my life. My father takes one of his arms and he puts it around me and I do the same. Take my arm and put it around him. My mother is still crying. She can't stop crying. Her youngest son has just been sentenced to 3 years in prison. My father and I hold her. We hold each other. We are a family. Though I have been their child for 23 years, we have never been a family. We are now. As we hold each other, as my mother cries for my wasted life, as my father tries to figure a way to save it, as I try to accept 3 years locked in a cell. My mother stops crying. Everything is streaked and stained, but she doesn't seem to care. She pulls her arm from my father and leaves her arm on me, and she wipes her face with her free hand. She sniffles. She takes deep breaths. She tries to compose herself. She speaks.
What are we going to do?
Wait and see, Mom.
I don't want you to go to prison.
I don't either.
What are we going to do?
Let's just wait and see. She nods, and her nod is some form of cue that we, my family, all understand. We pull away from each other and we sit, though not in our original chairs. We sit close, in a small half circle. We all know something has changed. We are all exhausted. The change has drained us. We sit close. We are a family. My father looks at his watch. I think it's about time for lunch. My mother and I stand. We walk toward the door, open it, step outside the room. My father speaks. We'll see you this afternoon.
Yeah.
My mother speaks.
Can I have another hug?
I smile. Sure. She steps forward. I put my arms around her. I am immediately uncomfortable, and I immediately feel as if I'm somewhere I don't belong. I gently squeeze. I am more uncomfortable, feel more foreign and out of place.
She squeezes me, which makes me want to run. This is my mother. I am hugging her. I don't want to hug her, but I want to try. I hold her tight, and I hug her. It is but a small price to pay for all that I have done. She releases me, and I step back. I feel better. I'll see you later. I turn, and I walk away through the halls and toward food. I am hungry. Hungry from the cold of last night, hungry from the tension of the morning, hungry to feed, just for the sake of feeding. Hungry. I enter the corridor. I glance through the glass to the women's side. I see Lily sitting at a table. She is pretending not to notice me, but I know that she does. I am pretending not to notice her, but she knows that I do. In her arms last night, after she cried, she clung to me like a lost child. She held me strong and thin, and she told me she never wanted to let go of me. She told me that she had never been so open or honest with anyone before, and that the feeling scared her to death. She told me that she never wanted to let go. She asked me about my plans for the future, and I told her I didn't have any, and I didn't know what I was going to do. She told me that she is going to a halfway house in Chicago, that she doesn't feel strong enough or free enough to live without some form of supervised support. She will be near her grandmother, and being near her grandmother will make her feel better. She will be able to get a job, and she will be able to start building a life in a city where she feels a sense of safety. After she finished speaking, she asked me again if I knew what I was going to do. I told her again I didn't know. She asked me if I had been to Chicago before, and I told her yes, that's where both my parents grew up. She asked if I still had family there, and I said yes. She asked if I would consider moving there, and I said yes. She asked if I was considering it because that is where she is going to be living. I smiled, and I thought for a moment, and I said yes. I get a tray, and I get in line. I get a plate of chipped beef, a plate of chicken strips and rice, a plate of turkey taquitos. I carry the tray to the dining room. My friends are at a table in one of the far corners. I walk toward them. I sit down so I can see Lily, and Lily can see me. Leonard and Miles and Ed and Ted and Maddie are talking about the imminent heavyweight boxing match. They ask me what's new. I tell them about my sentence. They are all surprised. They figured whatever time I was looking at was likely to be short and easy. Leonard asks what I did, and I tell him. Ed and Ted both say, "Nice work. 3 years for popping a cop is probably worth it." Maddie says he knows some good fighting tricks that will help me once I go inside, and he'd be glad to teach them to me. Miles asks in what jurisdiction the case is located. We eat. I glance at Lily. We talk. Prison is the main topic of conversation. Everyone at the table has been to prison except for Miles and me. Leonard did what he calls an easy four at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in Kansas. Maddie spent 6 years in a juvenile correctional facility where he learned to box. Ed did 2 years at Jackson in Michigan for assault with intent to inflict great bodily harm. Ted has twice been to Angola State Farm in the swamps of Louisiana. Miles says he has sentenced men to Angola, but he has never been there. He says from what he hears, it is hell on earth. It is located in the deep bog, hot, humid, and miserable, 50 miles from the nearest town. Cells are often open, the yard is basically unsupervised, and there are scores of gangs, usually organized according to race, that are in a constant state of war. The busiest part of the entire facility is the morgue. When men aren't fighting or hiding or trying to survive, they work 14-hour days in the state-owned fields, digging irrigation ditches and growing vegetables. Ted laughs and says it ain't that bad. Miles says if that's what you think, you are either the sickest man alive or you're just fooling yourself. Ted stops laughing and says he's facing life no parole there under the third strike law, and that if anything, he's just trying to get prepared for it. Miles asks what the strikes are, and Ted says armed robbery at 19, for which he did 4 years, possession of a controlled substance with intent to distribute, and possession of an automatic weapon when he was 25, for which he did 3 years, and most recently, at 30, statutory rape, after he was caught in the backseat of a Trans Am with the 15-year-old daughter of a small-town sheriff. Miles asks why the district attorney would push on the statutory charge if he knew Ted was facing life no parole. Ted laughs and he says he did the same thing with the DA's two daughters, but they were both in love with him and were unwilling to press charges. Miles shakes his head in disbelief and asks if Ted would like him to try and help him. Ted says, "Fuck yes, my life is at stake here." Miles says he'll see what he can do. We finish eating and we stand. As we walk out, I see Bobby sitting at a table with the familiar man, the menacing man, the man I know but do not know from where. Bobby is staring at me. The man is staring at me. I stare back. I hold my ground. We leave the dining room. My friends go to the lecture. I go to the family center. When I enter the main room, I see my parents in the same chairs they were in yesterday. As I walk toward them, they stand and they greet me. Dad speaks. "How was your lunch?"
"Okay."
Mom speaks. "Who did you eat with?"
"I have some friends in here."
"What are they like?"
"Do you really want to know that?" Dad speaks. "Of course we do. My closest friend is some kind of mobster. My roommate is a federal judge. My other friends are crackheads and drunks. I sort of have a girlfriend, and she's a crackhead and a pill popper, and she used to be a prostitute." My mother cringes, though she tries to hide it. She speaks.
"Are they nice people?"
I nod, smile. "They are, and in weird ways they're the best friends I've ever had."
"That's all that really matters, if they're nice people and you like them."
"I do, very much." Dad speaks. "Aren't male-female relationships against the rules here?"
"They are."
"Do you think you should be doing it?" "There are a lot of rules here. I try to follow most of them, but this girl, her name is Lily, has been good for me. She's cool, she's smart, she listens to me, I listen to her. We understand each other. We're different, and we come from different places, but in a lot of ways, we're the same. We're both wrecked. We're both trying to get better. We both need help, and we're trying to help each other." My mom speaks.
"Would I like her?"
"If you could get past what she's done and what she's been through..."
"I think I could."
"Then, yeah, you would. You'd like her a lot."
"Do you love her?"
"You know I don't like talking about that stuff with you, Mom."
"Maybe you can try, though?"
I smile, look down at the floor. I have hidden as much as I could from my mother and my father for my entire life. I don't want to do that anymore, so I look up, and I look at my mother, and I speak. "I haven't told her, but yes, I love her." My mother and my father smile. They are bright, genuine smiles. The best smiles I have seen since I have been here. My mother speaks.
"I wish we could meet her."
"You will, someday." My father speaks. "Next time you see her, will you tell her we said hello?" I smile. "I will." The bell rings. The man standing next to the bell tells us to go to the same rooms we were in yesterday. I stand and I say goodbye to my parents and I hug them. I am not comfortable doing it, but I do it anyway. I walk to the room. The chairs are arranged in a circle again. I sit down. A young woman is on one side of me, a middle-aged man on the other. We nod to each other and we say hello. Sophie walks.